Let me see if there are questions.
You know that Bach had a coffee cantata? Do you know that Bach? Bach had 16 to 20 cups of Turkish coffee every day. So apart from having a lot of children, he also kept himself away from the process. Would you please discuss on when family members whom you love and continuously try to reach out to shut you out, try to love, into love, yes, shut you up. Would you please discuss on when family members whom you love and continually try to reach out to shut you out, and who you love, yes. It's a very hard, very difficult one. It's a very difficult one. I know my brother has had that experience with his daughter, and it's a very trying thing because they're often, from what I've seen in the cases that I know of, there's a lot of blame going around. It's like, you didn't do this. You didn't do this. I blame you. I will never forgive you. I am punishing you by shutting you out. The only thing that we can ever do in cases like that, or with people that are angry with us and they won't listen to what we have to say, is to simply spend a lot of time praying for that person. Let me tell you my own experience. I'm 18 years old. I'm a student here at Santa Barbara City College. I've been going to Vedanta for 3 years. And there's a wonderful little Swami there that I love. He's a sweet little pumpkin of a Swami, and very sweet and holy, and I adore him and I trust him because when I would go into his presence, I would just feel his holiness, which I'd never encountered before. But so I thought from the time I was 15, I want to be a nun. I want to be a nun. Yeah, until I met my boyfriend. Don't forget that. I don't like the boy. So my boyfriend. So I was in City College, and then after we'd been going out, and you're trying to get married, of course, is what you do when you're just crazy in love. And then after I found out that he was starting to go around my back and see other girls, and then I found that he was actually going with another girl in particular, and he was actually taking the girl over to his parents' house. So I was like, and that felt like the ultimate betrayal. And I was so mad, and I felt so wrong, because, of course, you know, I was... You know, thinking this was a committed relationship and that we were going to get married and I was the good girl and he was bringing the other woman to his parents. So I went to Swami Prabhavananda and I said, I am so angry and I am so bitter. And he said, you can't be angry or bitter. I said, but I'm angry and bitter. And he said, you must pray for him. I don't want to pray for him. And he smiled and said, I'm for her. No! I hate her both. And he smiled and he said, no. You have to. Because I was in the truth. I was enjoying my righteous anger. I was wronged. I was wronged. I was humiliated. I was totally humiliated. And I felt I so deserved to at least milk that anger for what it was worth. Because it was mine. And what he said was, no, you have to pray for them. And so he said, envision the person at the feet of the Lord, and the Lord reaching down and blessing that person with his hand, which is the last thing I want to do. I want me bless, not schmuck bless. And her. So I did that because it was my spiritual teacher who told me to do that. And to my utter amazement, within about 3 days, my anger became dissipated because I could not put that person in the presence and really sincerely pray for that person being blessed by God. And I have found that to be my sneaky technique with a lot of things that I've encountered. That you often cannot speak to a person because they already know what they think you're saying. And they've already got their mind made up. You can't deal with a conscious mind to a conscious mind. because that part's blocked off. What you can do is through your love and prayers reach a different, deeper portion of their mind than they're aware of. And that we can only do through love and prayer. You can always change a situation, but not through this thing, not through the rational mind. And you can't say, but back then this. You have to go to a deeper place. Pray for them, love them, offer candles for them, let it be, pray, and then maybe at a certain point, and for God's sakes, don't tell them you're praying for them. Nothing more irritating. Just, you know, envision them and just love them. Love them. And eventually, in some part, they will feel your love, and that can bring them back. At a certain point, you might be able to write them a letter or through an intermediary. Don't do a head-to-head. It just doesn't work. Can you say something about the Hindu understanding of reincarnation? Yes. It's absolutely not necessary for anyone to believe that. The reason I believe in it was because the same reason that I actually ended up in Vedanta in the first place, which is a bizarre story, but true, as they all are. I was raised, as I said, I was raised half Episcopalian with a little bit of dribblings of Hindu thought thrown in here and there as an icing on the cake. And I had a real problem with the question of evil. It stuck in my craw. I could not adjust myself to it. I had a real problem with Job. Job was like, I've had a real problem with the Holocaust. You're testing 6 million Jews in the gas chamber. I cannot, an entire race to be exterminated. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand why my little girlfriend that I was in 7th grade with died a painful, horrible death of leukemia. I couldn't understand how a child who'd done no wrong in her life could be tortured and molested and killed. It's like, either God doesn't care, which doesn't make him God, or God is weak and helpless in the face of evil, which doesn't make him God. So I was really at an impasse. So I went after the Episcopalians, I went to the Unitarians, and that did not work. It's like social action. You know, it's like, So I just gave the whole thing up. I was like, well, hell with that. So I will try to do in my own life what I think is right, and that's all I can do. So there was a peace organization that I was part of in the year 1967 when we were organizing a march down State Street in Women's Strike for Peace. And I was all of 15 years old, trying to change the world. And every morning I'd wake up and say, I haven't stopped the war yet. You believe that for a 15-year-old with an enormous ego to think that you could change the world. So they paired us two by two to the churches in town. We were leafleting the churches, and so we went to Our Lady of Sorrows, and because that's the place where we had been sent to go. And we've used up all our leaflets, and what do we do? He said, the guy that I was paired with said, well, let's go to the Vedanta Temple. I said, what's that? He said, well, it's a really beautiful place, and they've got a big parking lot. Bingo. I found my place. So I came up for the Vedanta Temple for the windshield wipers. Because we lifted up every windshield wiper and stuck a leaflet in. Stuck a little organizing the marks in. And then he said, well, let's go inside. I went, can we go in there? He said, yeah, it's really beautiful inside. So then I walked in, and there was this very tall, skinny Swami speaking. And I was immediately put off because for one thing, he talked like that, and I didn't understand a word except for war. But he was really skinny, and that was a huge problem for me. I'm not going to go to any religion where they're fasting. Don't eat, I'm no Mahatma Gandhi for me, man. Fasting to death, forget to give me my coffee, my chocolate, and no fat. And so he talked, but I liked the atmosphere of the place. And because I liked the atmosphere, I just started looking around, and there was a painting of Jesus, and there was a painting of Buddha, and there was one of Ramakrishna in the front, who I heard later was a 19th century saint who preached the unity of all religions. And so when I started finding out about it, that's like, oh, I believe that. I believe that all the major religions of the world are preaching the same truth. that one that God doesn't say, okay, I'm giving it to you right there, and everyone else is going to hell. And if you don't happen to hear about it, well, we might send you purgatory. But if you actually raised this way, and let's say you're raised Muslim, and if you believe and don't believe in Jesus, and you heard about Jesus, you don't believe they're going to hell. It's like, how could you believe in God like that? So when I came to the Vedanta Society, they said, no, we believe all religions are true. We don't try to convert, because every path leads to the same goal. We're all on different roads going up the mountain. And we'll all get to the same place as long as we're sincere. As long as we are sincere and want God and not want to, let's say, take over the world, and we don't want to kill other people, we don't try to convert them and say, I won't feed you unless you want my religion. If we are sincere and want God, we'll all get to the same place because God is love. God just isn't loving. God is the nature of love. So how does this bring in karma? So when I used to hear about reincarnation from my mom, but I didn't really understand it. I was too young. The idea of reincarnation is totally linked with karma. And karma comes from the verb root, your Sanskrit for today, the verb root kri, which simply means to do. It is action and the effect of actions. Actions being both physical and mental. So what you sow, you shall reap. Whatever actions and thoughts you put out, you get back. The idea being is that not all of this will come through in one lifetime. They will come from another lifetime. This is why we say Mozart could write a symphony on a napkin at the age of 6, because he had the impressions from a previous life. Now, we believe that when we die, it's just this thing that goes away. It's just the body. The Bhagavad Gita said bodies are said to die, but that which possesses the body is eternal. This is eternal. So this goes from birth to birth with this mind in a seed form. Now remember, I was talking about these impressions that we make in our mind, these deep impressions. The impressions of anger or of kindness or of music or of anything that is very strong in our minds, that goes with us from birth to birth. The idea is whatever actions and thoughts we have had, we have desires. Our desires, our talents, our impressions, what we are, our character, will put us into a situation where they will spring forth the best. That we all have impressions, but we are put into situations where these impressions will flower. You might, when I was in India, for example, I was in a village, small village, but they had some very, very low caste, impoverished people. A kid about 3 years old, not even had any underwear, just a little filthy little t-shirt. On his hands and knees, picking up tin cans. He'd pick the tin cans up and he'd put them in front of himself. And then he would start playing an extremely complicated, what they call tal, a beat. Indian music is composed of very, very complicated rhythms with both the left hand and the right hand. While we tend to base things on a 4-4 beat, they do it on a 16 beat, on variations of a 3-2, 2-3, 6-9, 18-3. Very complicated things. This 2 to 3 year old picked these little cans up and was going, holy Jesus. This kid can't even walk. And he's playing these incredibly complicated talls. And so the parents didn't speak English, but I asked the Swami to say, what about this kid? And he said, the parents said, he's been doing it since he could reach. He would start playing those things. And they would say that this is an impression from a previous birth. That we all know babies who are born and they're like, this kid is so different than the other one. It's not just genes. It's also, so we say that a person is born into a situation where their karma, where the effects of their actions and thoughts will flower, where they are going to grow in the way that they will do and expect and have the background that they need in order to fulfill this karma in one way or the other. karma is not one of those things. There's so much cheesy karma stuff going around where it seems like, oh, it's your karma. You got a sore throat because you punched someone in the throat. No way. No way. It's nothing. Even Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says karma is so deep as to be incomprehensible. What we know is that whatever pain-giving karma we have put out, pain-giving karma will come back. So everything that we do to cause suffering comes back to us, whether it is physical or mental. It's a crapshoot. It doesn't really matter. It's just we have done certain things that will come back to us. They will come back. All in this is mixed up with what our own talents, what our own shortcomings are, what our strong points are, what impressions we have in our character of being, you know, the bad seed. You know, some kids are just born the bad seed. Perfectly fine parents, perfectly loving people. I mean, I know an absolutely delightful woman whose son was like breaking the law from the time he was in junior high. I have another good friend whose daughter, I knew her parents, I knew her grandparents. She was in AA by the time she was 13. Put $40,000 worth of fellowship money up her nose. It's like her brothers are so different, but it's like these previous impressions from a different life. So this is what we call karma. Karma and reincarnation are like that because whatever you have comes forth. This does not mean that if you see a person lying on the street and a bum, say, bad karma, I know you did something wrong. What it means is we've all been there, done that. Every person has been everything from a beggar to a king, from a prostitute to a nun. We've all been there. It's all learning experiences. These are all things to make us realize, to bring us to the place where we don't care about what this world has to offer except to the extent that God is there. It's all part of our spiritual evolution. We're not here to judge. We're here to serve. We're here to see other people as manifestations of divinity. So when we see a person in the gutter, or we see a person putting $40,000 up their nose, or we see a child molester, we know that person is suffering, and that their own suffering will hopefully bring them to the place where they will achieve understanding. Years ago, I met this incredible, wonderful woman, a very devout Catholic woman, who said that not only was she sexually molested by her father, her son was as well. And when she found out that her son was, she could not, it was like she couldn't bear it. And then she found out when she had a talk with her husband, and she said, I don't know how, and he said that he himself was molested. Now, how do you find this in one family? And I said, I don't know how you can bear it. And she said, no, you don't know what this has done for me. Because her suffering allowed her to overcome her own small thing. Because when it stopped being just about her, and she realized that other people suffered, she went into high gear, and she has started a foundation for molested children. She has done so much to educate other people and to bring children to a place where they don't feel ashamed to talk about it, where they can get help, instead of being where she was, or feeling like somehow she had brought this on herself. No, he's the problem. You're fine. So she said, no, I didn't realize that this was the way that God has blessed me. But she felt this is how God blessed her. So often our blessings come in the form of pain and suffering. Or if we choose, because it's all about our attitude. We've all seen people who, when they're faced with adversity or with a bad situation, turn in themselves and become bitter. If we create a bitter mind, we just make ourselves more miserable. We've also seen people who, when faced with adversity, make that into a way of a challenge of being able to serve and love others more. One of my favorite people, she used to come to the temple every night to meditate, because when she was pregnant, she said, I really want my baby to have all these wonderful, you know, the songs and the mind have this meditative feel. Well, her baby was born with Down syndrome. That's a hard package. And she said, No, because other people were saying, well, I'm so sorry. She said, no, I love my baby. And I'm going to make sure that in Santa Barbara we do everything we can for other Down's kids. And if she had not been put in that position, how many children would not get what they could have had because of her decision? No, this isn't about feeling sorry for me or for my baby. It's about me being the opportunity to see what other people have to live through. This has enlarged my vision. And instead of getting me feeling sorry for myself or my baby, it's about me saying, look what we share. Look what this problem is, and let's see how we can solve it together. So it's not a way of saying, you're bad, I'm good, I did wrong. It's about a way of empowering ourselves. How does this allow me to develop my spiritual life and to serve other people? So I talk way too much. What questions do we have? Yes.
Does karma have a positive aspect?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. You'll find people who, a friend of ours, Wendy. Wendy said, I don't know what I have done, but she said, I never have problems in my life. She was born into a pretty bad situation in London right after the bombing, and there was no food. It's like there was food rush and everything. It was very, very tough. She had she came from a very, very poor family in her whole neighborhood. No one ever got through high school, let alone college. They were a hardcore working class people who just tried to make ends meet. Well, she just had these things happen to her. We're like, no, we think you want to go to Oxford with a scholarship. So she goes to Oxford and they say, no, we think you want to have a show on BBC. So she had a show on BBC. Then, you know, all these things kind of happened, and she didn't have to ever take the initiative. They just happened. But on her own, she's been very good about sharing what things have happened to her and always being generous and kind. But yes, there is, all karma is mixed. No action that we ever do is always 100% good. I mean, I'm sure you can, you know, it's like, yeah, you make breakfast for your family, but you killed somebody's egg. Mm-hmm. You know, or you pulled off the weed, or you know, it's like you stepped on a worm. Mm-hmm. So it's like everything is mixed. But everything really depends on our attitude. Because as long as our attitude is one of trying to do what is kind and generous and good, how we can serve God and serve others at the same time, it's always, I mean, often we can do things that look good, but we're doing it for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. It's like we're doing it, like, oh, that's wonderful, but in fact, our real reason is like, you want people to praise you. That's the wrong reason to do it. You know, you can't do it because you want pats on the head. You have to do it because you're doing it from within, out of love. And if you don't get the pats, it's just as fine as if you don't get the pats. Because then we're always dependent upon other people. Then we're not coming from that place of fullness, of that God's presence in our heart. The minute we become dependent on other people's reactions to us, that's the minute we're just offering ourselves up to be at their mercy. We can't be at the mercy of other people's moods. We have to come from our own place, the divine. It's like, God is in my heart, and if you're having a bad day, I'm not going to make that affect me and think, oh God, what did I do wrong? God is in my heart, God's in your heart, and I'm sending you blessings. Yeah, anything else? Yes?
I'm in view of what you said about what we give off is what we get back. Is there an explanation in the Hindu religion for how Jesus ended up on the cross?
Yes, he willed to do so. He took on the karma of people. Because an incarnation, because we do believe that God incarnates, and the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, whenever evil increases, whenever goodness grows weak, I make myself a body for the good of humanity, to raise up the righteous, and to you know, give people hope. So for the good of the world, Christ willingly allowed himself to be crucified. Were Jesus in a different age, would he have to be crucified? I suspect not. But he lived in a brutal age. He lived in a time where people were so thick that the only thing that they would understand was that man, the Son of God, being held up on a cross and being tortured. And that even under those conditions, that he could speak to his Father and not condemn the sinners. That showed under that extremity that God is the reality above all realities. But you see, that's because of the conditions of the time. Would Christ today have to be there? I very much doubt it. Maybe Christ would have. Maybe the incarnation would come having a different form. Krishna, we believe that God incarnates in different ways at different times. It's not a tenet because we have none, but many Hindus believe that. They believe that Buddha was the incarnation, that Krishna was the incarnation. Buddha died of food poisoning. This hunter came to him and said, I would be very happy if you would eat this food. Well, it was an old piece of rotten meat. So he was 80 years old. And so he knew what he was doing. Buddha knew. But he knew it was time for the body to go because it's just the body. And when his disciple Ananda came, he said, no, don't. He said, how could you have done that? It's poison. And he said, he had no idea that I could not eat this. You know, hunters, you know, we've got a different digestive system. So he said, he did it from love and kindness. He said, Ananda, he has done me the greatest blessing. He's releasing me from my body. Don't look to Buddha the man. Be a lamp unto yourselves. That lamp is in our hearts. Jesus, that lamp of Abba the Father. It's not the historical personality. It's what they said. It's their actions that we have to replicate in our own lives to make that living for us. So in every age, we think God comes. We believe that Rama was an incarnation. And many that we don't even know. Maybe who lived in caves, but their holiness pervaded the atmosphere, just raising people's minds so that they thought of God. We don't know. All we know is that of those who came, they never came to condemn. They never came to assign blame. But they did say to love. To love and to not get trapped in the mires of the ego. To always give, to always be generous, to always be unselfish, and to always think of others and to see others as manifestations of divinity. Every single manifestation of God has said that. Most people don't know the Quran very well, and if they would read the Quran, they would see what beautiful things are there. But we're so quick to say the other believes that.
We don't believe that.
The other. Read some of the songs like that. It's scary. I will. Yeah. Totally scary. Just listen to the Messiah. I will dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Mm-hmm. That's cheerful. Merry Christmas.
If Krishna was incarnated, would he have been born in Mayapur? Would he have been born in Mayapur?
We don't say it's the same. We would say that it's a way of Jesus giving faith to the people at the time, because they were so dense. I mean, they couldn't believe it except for a bodily resurrection. They couldn't believe. I mean, they were so not imbued with faith. They had so little faith that a man could actually suffer and say these things, that it actually had to be that way, that the tombstone had to roll out. Even Jesus' own disciples didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to have the Marys. You had to have Mary Magdalene to be able to say no, no. I mean, even those who, his own, the most dear to him who could deny him and say it's not possible.
So the bodily resurrection, so is there identity, or what happens when you die? Do you lose your sense of?
We say you lose your sense of your name, maybe. But interestingly, this is just a total thing. they've done studies on reincarnation in India of children. And what they found is a doctor by the name of Ian Stevenson has done nothing but go over to India and check reminiscence of children who say that they remember their past lives. As you get older, you forget because you get new impressions, you know, adding on, so you have all these things taking on, but when they're very young, they've had documented cases, and there's entire books by this guy called Ian Stevenson about people, children go back and say, you go to that village over there, you will find In this house, you go to the second room, there's an Elmira. You pull, move the Elmira, there's a door there, open up the door, you go down, that's where I kept my money. They will say, my wife's name was this, I have three children by that name, 100% of the time. I'm sorry, something like 90% of the time with children, it's been absolutely spot on. With adults, it's something like 50 to 60%, because their adult memories get in the way. They had one fairly recently that I just read about a man who grew a little boy who was born, and he was 4 years old, and he said, I was murdered. I was murdered. You go over to that village. I worked for that landlord. He had me murdered. His daughter said that I raped her. I did not. He had, and in fact, when they went over, they found out the man, he said, if you look, he threw me down a well. And they went down into the well and they found parts of the body. And when they questioned the people, they found that indeed the daughter had had an affair, but she didn't want to admit that she'd had an affair because, you know, she didn't get married after that. So she blamed it on the worker, the man who was, and then because the father was incensed, he had the man killed. And this absolutely backed up. Is it necessary to believe that? Absolutely not. It really doesn't matter. What matters is this life. This is the only one we really know about. All we know is this life, that this life and the people we see every day and our own minds, our own hearts, we need to purify our hearts. We need to go into the closet and pray. Absolutely blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That's basically where we come from. What we did back then, who cares? Garbage in, garbage out. I think it's a blessing we don't remember. Because I have a hard time remembering when I was 7 hours ago. If I did something good or bad then, that's dandy. And I suppose I'll feel the effects now. But in the long run, the only thing that matters is what we're thinking right now. What we do today. That's the only thing that matters. And this hocus pocus about come sit down and I'll tell you why you've got problems. Oh, in your last life. Doesn't really matter. If we have problems now, just let's try to change our own attitude so that what we do now, we can have a much better future. And let's try to change our own mind so that when something happens to us, we can feel joyful and at peace, rather than thinking, it should have happened this way. But it didn't. So, this is for the best. Yeah?
So then if a child dies, like for your friend, does that mean they completed?
They completed that thing with that person. It's not to say they won't see each other again another time, in another form.
But, so they lived 4 years and they died, and does that mean they're done and they've reached that enlightened state?
No, it just means that unless the person dies with the knowledge that they are one with God the Father in their hearts, until we don't want anything out here, until we want only God. If you die thinking, God, I wish I could be a millionaire. I really wanted to have money. I really want to see her again. I really want whatever desires you have in your mind, that's going to propel you, whatever your desires are, as you're dying. Those will go right into the next life, and that will have its effect on where you go to the next time. But whatever in your lifetime, it's like they say your whole life goes before your eyes when you die. And they say in the Hindu tradition, all your impressions, all your strong impressions compress. And that's what goes through your mind. So it isn't like you can cheat and at the last, I'm gonna think of God now. It can't be done. Because it's like a tidal wave coming. It's like at the very end in this whole, you know, tsunami is coming of all your thoughts and actions. They're all coming now, and the sum total is what you get. And that is gonna give you the sort of impetus to go right into your next life. So if there is desire on the girl's part to spend to work out some karma with that person, they probably will. We don't know. But until that person dies with the sense of my whole life has been about finding my true self in God, my whole life is that I don't want anything, Lord, but you. You're the only thing I want. Then they'll get it.
And then when you're propelled on, do you choose the next?
In a sense, because your own desires choose your parents. It isn't so much a conscious thing about whatever desires you have are going to put you in that position, along with what they have. It's a very complicated game.
Is there, in some of those countries, a conflict between Hindus and Buddhists, and what is the conflict?
I don't know of any conflicts between Hindus and Buddhists. In Sri Lanka there is. It has absolutely nothing to do with the philosophy, but a lot to do with the fact that which people have the land, which people have the money. As it is with every sort of thing where it's purportedly about religion. Same thing right now in the sections of India where there's a Hindu-Christian violence, and that has nothing to do with the religion, but a lot to do with their political system that says if you belong to a lower caste, you get 60% of the jobs. If you belong to a minority religion, which is a Muslim or Christian, you get this amount percentage of jobs. So in some places in that particular area where they're having Hindu-Christian riots, they said, okay, if you are a low caste and a Christian, you are allowed 70% of the jobs. And that's when, because there's not enough money, there's not enough resources, there's not enough jobs, they said, this is unfair. It's unfair. Because people can convert and do whatever they want and just be able to get a job, and God knows what they're doing. It has nothing to do with their religion. So it's all about politics. Yeah. But the thing in Sri Lanka has absolutely nothing to do with the religion, because there's very little difference between the religions. Yeah.
When a soul reincarnates and it evolves at the next incarnation, when does it stop reincarnating, and what happens?
Then you merge into God. And if you come back, it's with the knowledge. It's with the knowledge that you are one with God. They say that you become one with God the Father, that you sort of merge into God, or depending on, say you can live in total in the presence of God. It depends on which school that you happen to belong to. I don't know. I can't remember.
There is an end to reincarnation.
There is an end, because going around and around and around, it's just the same old stuff. You know, it's like, what's the point? Like, oh God, another cup of coffee, another piece of chocolate, and a car accident. You know?
Is it at all disturbing to you to know that when you die, it's not, you're not kind of at a peaceful end, but that you're going to go somewhere and you don't know where?
I've been around people who've died, and I have yet to be around a death that's not peaceful, because every death, and I've in my job, you get to see people die. I go to hospitals a lot. And the deaths that I have seen are so peaceful and joyful, because it isn't like the idea of, like, you're not going where you don't. You are going into something so less. Even when you reincarnate, it isn't like you go right into the next cycle. It's like you have this place of getting out of the body, of being in a place until, you know, you find the position where you're going to go. I don't know what those, I mean, there's these different states. Some say it's this place, and some people like this place. But it's never against, it's like always with the thought that you're doing more in your spiritual evolution. You're getting closer and closer to God. And I've never been around a person who's dying that I didn't feel like it was a blessing to be there. Just people who, even children, it's like, I've seen some absolutely beautiful deaths. A guy that I know had a really painful death of AIDS. I saw him, he looked up, he was in and out of a coma, and he looked up over the door of the hospital room, and he went, and he died. Mm-hmm. It's like, whatever he saw, I want to go there. Not getting my chance over. Well, I hope this dispels the stereotypical myth of what a Hindu nun might be like. Sitting in the temple all day praying and totally removed from the world. So thank you for breaking that illusion for us. And thank you. It's just so, I love Word and Life being so open, how we grow and how humbling it is and how enlightening.
to have somebody like Raja Prana come from an entirely different tradition and speak really on these chapters and see that in the heart of silence and solitude in that more mystical portion of all traditions, we truly are one. And the other things that divide us simply don't seem to enter the conversation. And I think that's a very important part of our spiritual growth. So thank you so much for coming. Does the Hindu tradition have a tradition of blessings?
Sure.
Do you want to do a closing blessing for us? Because Gail's not here today, we usually do a song, but I'll let you do a blessing for us.
We have so many different blessings. Let me give you...
Om Asatama Sadgamaya Jyotirma Gamaya Mrityorma Gamaya Abhiravirma Heti Rudrayate Dakshinamukam Tenamapahinityam Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Om. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through ourselves, and guide us evermore with their sweet, compassionate face. Om. Peace, peace. Peace be unto us all.